let's begin today with a muscle, with a metaphor of sorts. So imagine you were a double-A second baseman for the, you know, do you have any minor league baseball teams in Illinois? The Peoria, the King County Cougars, exactly. So imagine you were double-A, good morning, welcome. The double-A shortstop, the second baseman for the King County Cougars. And someone asked you to analyze and describe Willie Mays. So you would say that's pretty ridiculous. I'm a double-A second baseman in 2018. I never met Willie Mays. And even if I had met Willie Mays, I probably wouldn't have been able to grasp what was so special about him, because I'm just a utility infielder on a double-A baseball team, and I'm going to go back to being, you know, whatever I do after that.
You know where this is going.
So we know exactly where this is going.
That's kind of true.
Well, it is definitely true. So as we now have discussed for many months different aspects of Misora and the importance of Misora and in general, so now we're going to start to transform our discussion into something a little bit more practical in terms of what are the core ingredients that comprise our unique Misora. So I've had several conversations and I've started to identify for myself what are some of the substantive, definitional aspects of our community and our Misora. So I have a list, but to validate that list, as we've talked about in the past, we need Bali HaMisora. We need people who teach us and model for us and substantiate those values for us. So before we can talk about what those values are, which we will get to, do not worry, I thought it was very important that at least some of the figures over the past number of decades who are the guiding lights of this Misora, we should get to know them. But, as I just alluded to, there are different ways to get to know people. So if you're a utility infielder trying to talk about Willie Mays, you can say, you know what, I can't tell you so much about Willie Mays, what kind of a ball player he was. I can't really grasp, like, the full greatness of this remarkable player. I could share with you some highlight reels that I found on YouTube. That you could probably do. But better yet, you know what I can do? If you ever look on the back of a baseball card, you will find statistics, and they'll show exactly every year what his on-base percentage was, and how many walks, and how many hits, and how many stolen bases. So that's what we're going to do today. When we talk about Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, who, I guess, first and foremost in Chicago, was Rabbi Aaron's brother. So that's one important thing to put out there. And we'll come back to Chicago a few times, don't worry. But we're really talking about somebody for whom the term giant is wholly inadequate, and certainly for somebody like me who's just kind of beginning on their journey of understanding what Rav Soloveitchik was all about, I hope that I'm the utility infielder. But what we're going to do today is not try to grasp the greatness or even the worldview or the insight of Rav Soloveitchik. Today we're just going to read the back of the baseball card. That's it. We're going to share a biographical sketch of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik so that we know who this person was as we start to talk about what he represents and what he taught us. So to do that, I'm calling upon this work, which is a two-volume work called The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik by Rabbi Rakefet. So he has about a 60-page introductory biography that I went through. And then, what makes this presentation special is a collection of primary sources that were provided to me 10 years ago when Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter came to Chicago to spend a day with the Kollel Fellows. It was the first year of the Kollel, and he came to kind of give us, I guess you would call it an in-service. You know, he gave us shiurim on different topics. kids, which were amazing. So first, I took the thick packet that he gave us, and I stuck it in a file. And so I'm calling from some of those, and then subsequently he gave some others. So we're going to draw upon those and walk through the life of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik through this biographical sketch, and hopefully we'll learn a few things along the way. An introductory note to this biographical sketch, which we don't have time for at length, is Rav Soloveitchik's family history. Which the truth is, I should have brought the whiteboard today for this, because if you try to connect Rav Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik family, to the Netziv and the Berlin family, they are related, but it's a very complicated story, because the Netziv had a first wife and a second wife, and it's not for today. But Rav Soloveitchik's parents, who you see actually on page one, this is the wedding invitation. If you would have been invited to the wedding invitation, to the wedding of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, which you see is on Thursday, Yom Hei Chavav Sivan Habal Lima Latova, that's Tav Resh Samach Aleph, which is June 13th, 1901, you would have been invited by, on the bottom, Chaim Halevi and Lifshe Soloveitchik to their children's wedding, Moshe Halevi and his wife Heshka, the daughter of Eliyahu Halevi, the Rav of Prujan, of Elia Prujan. So Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's parents were Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and the Rebbetzin Pesha Feinstein. They were both the Levinim, they were both families of Levinim. Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, as you see signed here on the bottom, was the none other than the world famous Rav Chaim Halevi. Did you see there's a chair? Yeah, what was that? Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's father was Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the original Beis Halevi. That's obviously the namesake of Rav Joseph Soloveitchik, the original Beis Halevi, and Rabbi Joseph B, and then his son Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik were involved in teaching in the Voloshin Yeshiva, which we don't have time to talk about today, but that's a whole other world in and of itself. For the Voloshin Yeshiva, Voloshin is the suburb of Vilna, and Voloshin Yeshiva, you could argue, is like the mother of almost all major yeshivas in Eastern Europe, except in the small few like Mir, which was a Polish yeshiva, and a few others. The main branch, I guess you call it the trunk of the tree of the world of yeshivas, came from this yeshiva that was called Eitz Chaim, which was, by the way, the original name of Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Reitz was originally called Yeshiva Eitz Chaim because it was named after the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, the Volozhin Yeshiva, that was founded by Chaim Volozhin, the student, the top disciple of the Vilna Gaon. However, when the yeshiva was closed in the late 19th century, the 1880s, so then essentially there was a yeshiva in New York, they got together, they called it Eitz Chaim, and then when they, pick and choose, but Rav Yitzchak Spector, who was arguably the Gaon Hador, he was more senior than Chafetz Chaim, he was older, and he was the most senior rabbinic figure in the world at that time. I believe it was 1896 when he died, and that's why the yeshiva was renamed Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan after Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's factor. Okay, so let's leave Voloshin, and because we could spend several weeks just on Voloshin and Rav Chaim and the Beis Halevi, but we want to kind of fast forward. So Rav Soloveitchik's parents, his father was the son of Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, who was a rav not just in Voloshin as a melamed, as a Rosh Yeshiva, but he was a rav in the community in the small town of Brisk. So Rav Chaim was the rav in Brisk, and he there he raised his children. He had one son who we spoke about once before, Rav Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik, Rav Velva, and then he had his other son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Rav Moshe married, as you see here, the Rebbetzin Pesha Soloveitchik, Pesha Feinstein, her father was Rav Eliyahu of Prujan, which was a Polish town. And it's interesting, Rav Soloveitchik himself believed that his parents were different from each other. They also had kind of different upbringings and different worldviews. The Soloveitchik family was very, can you say peculiar? Is that okay to say that? They're kind of a peculiar dynasty. For example, one of the peculiarities about the Briskers and the Soloveitchiks is that they are very they are very loath to publish. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's Chizushin Torah were only published by the Vizcarel, by Reb Velvel, after his death in the 1930s. So they're very perfectionist about things like that. So they won't publish a lot of things. In their lifetime, Reb Soloveitchik himself, especially in the early years, didn't publish very much at all. I would say much, I can't say, who's to say, there are many essays were published at the time, but since he passed away, tons and tons of materials, over 10 volumes of the Torah Surah, those were published posthumously. He did not publish those for whatever reasons. So the family of Rizk, his father, grew up in the home of Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was, there's a letter from 1899 where Reb Chaim was very opposed to Zionism and any involvement in Zionism because the Zionist leaders were not religious. It was kind of a very strict and rigorous, austere perspective, whereas the Rebbetzin Peshit was from the Feinstein family that was much more open and worldly and engaged, and that's going to have an influence on Rav Soloveitchik himself. So his parents are married in 1901, and he was born in Prusian in 1903. The reason why he was born in Prusian is because his parents lived, his parents lived, his Rav Moshe Soloveitchik lived in his in-laws' house in the Feinstein home for several years, as was the minhag in those days, that the Elia parishioners supported them, and he was learning and teaching in Prusian with his grandparents. So Rav Soloveitchik has a very early memory that's published in an essay that he wrote. I did not read the whole essay yet. It's for like, not for when I retire, but you need serious amounts of time to handle this essay. It's called Ubikashna Misham. It's one of Rav Soloveitchik's most important essays. He published it only in the late 1970s, although he wrote it in the 1940s, which is interesting. Which is, I think he viewed it as the follow-up or the superseding essay to Isha Halacha. But in this volume, he tells a story. Let's read the story together. Go to page 2. Yes.
It's interesting, right? I don't know what happened to the Feinsteins. Maybe they didn't. I guess they paid afterwards. I don't know. Maybe they had. Or maybe they wrote their own invitation. I don't know. I don't even know where Rabbi Schachter got the copy of this invitation, which is interesting. Okay, so let's go. Oh, I'm out of order here. Go to page 3. I don't know why I put them backwards. 3 first. And I want to read this story together because, A, it describes the formative experiences that Rav Soloveitchik had as a child, but also it reinforces what we're doing this entire year and why this series is important. Let's start. Who wants to volunteer to start? It's on the right side of page 3. I would like to relate. It's a long piece. We're going to read it to take a couple of volunteers. Now, I think that was a nod. That's it. You got it. I would like to relate.
I would like to relate a personal experience to illustrate the idea of the accelerator we're discussing. I remember myself as a child. I was afraid of the world. I thought it was a good one for me. I had one friend, Mr. Wells, and he's so rare that we were going to lose the handbag. How did we become friends? We met. Rabbi was a regular guest in my house. Those were the days when my father and Andrew were still living in the home of my grandfather, the Wolf and Pilot. Father sat and studied Torah day and night. About a small group of us, he and the Torah scholars gathered around and came out to see us close to me. Father's lectures were given by Grandfather's living room in the oldest place. I used to sit up in bed and listen to my father talk. And Father's always said about the mountain, this is how we can proceed. He wrote a volume of the Torah and then read a passage. Then he would say, this is the interpretation of Rabbi Isaac and the other Joseph. I always see him write on interpreting the passage. Father would always find that the Rabbi had offered a different interpretation and he deviated from the simple way. And Father would say, oh, this is a complaint against the Rabbi. We don't understand our master's reason or the way he explains the passage. He could assure you to complain to the Rabbi directly, but they will worship and lie on you.
Okay, let's turn back to page 2. Who wants to pick it up next? Elaine, you're on. You nodded. Don't worry about the Latin. Don't worry about the Latin.
My father was
Prima facie, yeah.
The criticisms and objections of the robot are true. The members of the group jump up and each of them will suggest an idea. Congress is listening and love their ideas and then repeat it. Ideas, two commanders, highlights, colleagues, two crash, a colleague. He was ready to stare, who would rest his head on his business. The group was quieting in Ashley's turbo's reflection, and for a long while, he would take his head very slowly and move it. And at times, let's see. And then he would start to talk. Sometimes he would say, for example, every time something would happen, I would turn my ears and listen to what he would say. I did not understand anything at all about the issue under discussion, but two impressions were behind me out in the one, the Rambam was surrounded by opponents and enemies from to harm him, and two, he was only using Joe as my father. Who knows what was in the Rambam? I felt that the Rambam himself was present in the room and listening to what my father was saying. The Rambam was sitting there. What did he look like? I didn't know what he said, but his countenance was at home. My father's twin. He was the same thing as his father, Moses. Father would speak with Judah's eyes fixed on him. He was listening to what he was saying. Smoke was seen with attention at his father's throat. Boldly and bravely, two light beings emerged. A lot of them were regulated and then defined with wondrous precision. A new light shone. The difficulties were resolved, the passengers exclaimed. The Rambam emerged the winners. Father's face shone with justice. He had defined with his friend. The rain and rush of the sunshine, a smile of satisfaction appeared on the Rambam. I too participated in this journey. I was happy and excited. I would jump on the bed and run to my mother to tell her to jump on this. Mother, the Rambam is right. He defeated the Rambam. Father came to me. How wonderful, Father.
Okay, who wants to pick up the last piece? Thanks,
Jeremy. The candle of the Rambam is locked in that hole. The enemy who had him on both sides. To his poet as I am. Author was unable to follow the logic of his position. He tried to build his mighty defending, but he was unsuccessful. Author would sink his knees into his head leaning on his fist. Soon into the night, even the Rambam himself was sensing the father's answer. When Father would pick up his head and say sadly, the answer will have to go to the father. The Rambam said he was extremely difficult. There was no expert who could explain it. The issue remained in need of clarification. The whole group, my father included, was sad to the point of tears. A silent agony expressed itself on each face. Tears came out of my eyes. And I would even see bright teardrops in the Rambam's eyes. Slowly, I would go to Mother and tell her in a broken heart, Mother, Father can't resolve the Rambam. What should we do? Don't be sad, Mother would answer. Father will find a solution for the Rambam. If he doesn't find one, then maybe, when you grow up, you'll resolve his words. The main thing is to learn to talk with joy and excitement.
Thank you. So that was the youth of Rav Soloveitchik in Fruzhen. In 1910, his father became a rabbi in a small Lithuanian town called Rasin, where they then moved out of the grandparents' home. And he stayed there for 3 years until they moved to Khaslavich. Khaslavich was another town which had, where Moshe Soloveitchik was the Rav, but this town had a large Hasidic population of Chabad Hasidim. And there, Rav Soloveitchik was sent to learn under the tutelage of the Chabad Malamed. And this Chabad Malamed taught Rav Soloveitchik the Tanya, which is the classic Hasidic work of the Alter Rebbe, which there's Zalman of Liadi. This had a very significant impact on Rav Soloveitchik's life that he reflected on. And if you remember, we mentioned not too long ago that Rav Lichtenstein, Zichron Levracha, mentioned that one of the summers in Boston, when the Rav felt that his students were, quote, spiritually desiccated, what did he choose to teach them? He taught Tanya. And he recalled himself how he knew passages of the Tanya by heart. And it's not clear exactly whether his father or grandfather knew exactly what was going on with this Chabad Malamed, but they weren't learning the Rambam, they were learning Tanya.
but
for sent him there.
Right. But then they sent him back, and then he became a student of Rav Moshe exclusively. He left his Chabad Malamed, but the impact was felt on him. So if you look on the next page, you have an interesting letter that that Rav Soloveitchik wrote. You see it says at the beginning of Tuf Shin Tesvav means the middle of 1955 to a friend, a great Gadol. He writes unbelievable honorific titles here to this Moreno Rav Dov Ber Rifkin. So I don't know who that is. If I did enough research, I could probably find out. By the way, generally, if you see somebody's name is Dov Ber, that's a dead giveaway that they are very likely, not always, but very likely connected with Chabad. It's because of that. You have Chabad connections in your family? Well, you can check. Very often, Dov Ber, you will find, is going to be a Chabad name. So this letter to Rabbi Rifkin in 1950s, Rav Soloveitchik writes, this is Greenfield, you see, it says Roxbury 21, Massachusetts. So meaning this was before, you're saying. Okay, so I don't know where this is, but wherever it is, South Boston. Okay, so he writes, I got your letter and I'm trying to write back to you as soon as I can. Why? Because I mechabed you very much, I honor you greatly, and number two, look in the underline where the base is, Chiba Yesera, Hinemi Rochesh L'Tnuas Chabad. I have a special affinity to the Lubavitch movement, says Rav Soloveitchik. Why? Because I remember my youth, Demus Yuvi Malamde, underline Rav Baruch Yaakov Gisberg Zal. And he says, I still remember his countenance and the influence that he had on me all these decades later. What an impact this Chabad Melamed had on Rav Soloveitchik. And he says, I still see in my mind's eye the Chabad Hasidim in Chaslavich dancing in circles around my grandfather, around and around, in a fast circle dance on Shmini Atzeres. He writes in the bottom of the underline. It says how much I love Chabad. And by the way, now people make a lot out of this, that Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav and the Rebbe, I think there's a book, there's a lot written about Rav Soloveitchik's connection to Chabad. There are a lot of famous pictures of a Fabrengen in 1980 when the Rav came to 770 to join this Fabrengen with Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, whom he knew from their time in Berlin, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So Rav Soloveitchik had this Hasidic experience that was very much a part of his life. And then something else happened. In 1920, they left Chaslavich and they went to Warsaw. They went to Warsaw because his father became a Rav in a school. The school is called Tach Kamoni. What is unique about this school? What is significant? Because Tach Kamoni was number one in a very big city. It was in Warsaw, which was, I guess, outside of Lithuania's Vilna, which maybe you could call the capital of Jewish learning, but Warsaw was the capital of Jewish learning. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of Jews, the largest concentration in Eastern Europe, and it's a very big cosmopolitan city, and the Tach Kamoni school was a school that encouraged integrating secular studies and worldly education into your Torah education. Here comes Rav Soloveitchik in 1920, and his father is already involved in this kind of pursuit. A couple of years later, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik will leave Tach Kamoni, and he will emigrate to New York to become Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Sorbini Yisrael Gochanan. Another, it was at that time Yeshiva University, it didn't become a university until 1945. But the idea of Dr. Revels from the Rav of synthesizing worldly education with Torah education was not foreign to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. At this time, Rav Soloveitchik starts attending some high school classes. He describes in a letter that he graduated from a gymnasium in Dubno in 1922, and then in 19
1924, he attends the Polish Free University. And then in 1926, after three semesters, he moves to the University of Berlin. In Berlin, he meets quite an interesting cast of people. On the scholarly side, the University of Berlin, of course, this is a major European university with all-star professors and academics, but there were also very significant folk personalities who were in Berlin at that time, none other than the Berlin Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, named after Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. They had several great rabbanim who were there, in addition to another young student in the University of Berlin at that time, which was Rav Nachum Mendel Schneerson, and others who were Torah personalities who were absolutely connected to. One of the most senior one of them was a man, a great Torah Gaon who later emigrated to America and survived the war, was known as Rav Chaim Heller, who Rav Soloveitchik was mastered when Rav Chaim Heller died in 1960. He viewed Rav Chaim Heller as his older mentor, a very, very important influence, and he met Rav Chaim Heller because Rav Chaim Heller had a small base medrash in Berlin at that time. Rav Soloveitchik studies in Berlin, and he earns his doctorate from the University of Berlin, which is pictured on your next page. Page number four. Yeah, he was born in 1903. He was 20 much later in the 1950s. So he's reflecting back 40 years later to what his childhood was like. So a big piece of his childhood was his father learning in the living room. A big piece of his childhood was watching the Chabad Hasidim dance on Shmini Atzeres. Now these are formative experiences for him. On the left side, you actually see my line is very weak, let's just say, non-existent. On the left side, you see the doctorate that Rav Soloveitchik received, Joseph Soloveitchik. You see the Soloveitchik spelling here is Polish, exactly. Polish, and then on the right side, you see Rav Soloveitchik's dissertation on the thought of Hermann Cohen, who was a post-Kantian, a neo-Kantian philosopher in the 19th century, which is another story for another time. Very interesting story, Hermann Cohen and his life. While he's in Berlin, he meets a young woman by the name of Tanya Lewitt, who is from Vilna. Her family is related to the family of Abchaimels or Krasinski, the great Gaon, the chief rabbinic authority, I would say, in the world by this time. He dies just before the Nazis arrive in 1940 in Lithuania. So Soloveitchik and Tanya, and young Joseph B. Soloveitchik and Tanya, they go to be married in 1931 in Vilna, but his parents by now are in New York. Their Masada Kedushin is Rav Chaim Ozer, but their wedding invitation, which is pictured on the top of the next page, is very simple. It says, Tanya Lewitt, Joseph Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, we invite you to enjoy our wedding celebration on the third of the week, the first of Tammuz 1931, 16th of June 1931, Kiyoska number 4, Vilna, period. His doctorate was awarded in December 32. Right. So you notice how his parents are not on the wedding invitation? Because they weren't there. Because they were in America. And they weren't going to Rome, Vilna for his wedding. But at this time, Rav Soloveitchik is already known as a preeminent Gaon, a giant in the world of Torah. There are many letters that Rav Soloveitchik wrote to his father and to other rabbanim when he was in Berlin, and I think I can understand the content of the question of the letters. The questions, most of them I can pretty much understand. The topics of these letters are far-ranging and just the most incredibly detailed aspects of Kachin and Taurus, some of the most complex areas. I think when Dr. Lichtenstein, Tova Lichtenstein, was here last year, she wondered aloud if maybe the reason why Rav Soloveitchik in his later years focused primarily on Nashim and Nezikin and not on Kachin was kind of because he felt like he did that already once. Like when he was in Berlin, he already conquered all of Taros and all of Kachin and all of Nashim and all of Zroim. So let's do something more traditional for the people. But the scope of his greatness, there are many, many different anecdotes, but here you have have a published letter that was published in Hapardes, which we've talked about before because it was published right here by Rabbi Hapardes in Chicago, in 1932. This letter is authored by Mechtovo Shel Hagon Hagaro Ha'av Bezdin of Kihilas Kovno. This letter is authored in 1931. The same time that the Rav is studying for his doctorate, he's getting this letter of Haskama from the Kovno Rav, of Avram Dover Kahana. The Kovno Rav, Kovno, first of all, was one of the most significant Torah communities in the world. It was a suburb of Vilna, and they had the first Kovno that was established in the 19th century. And the Kovno Rav was one of the most renowned rabbinic figures. He also dies just before the Nazis arrive, or just after, I forget exactly when, before the liquidation of the Vilna Jewry. He moves to Vilna, and then he passes away. He was very ill, but he was still an active leader at the beginning of the war when the Soviets controlled Vilna and Kovno. He was one of, next to Reb Chaim Ozer, the greatest rabbinic luminary, and he's actually, he's pictured in a very interesting photograph where he came from Kovno, and Rav Kook, who came from Israel, and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chevron of Slobodka, they all came to America on a massive fundraising trip to try to raise money for the impoverished Yeshiva students in Europe, because if you remember, after World War I and into the Depression, the economic state of the yeshivas in Europe was dismal, terrible. So the three of them, these are the three great Gaoni Hador who came to America, and it's an awesome picture of them, and Fiorella LaGuardia at a reception in New York, who was at that time the mayor of New York City. He was more famous then than he is for an airport that's under construction. What does the Dvar Avram write? He says, Kochav Gadol, a great star, Umazir Ketseis HaShemesh Begvuyaso, Ola Al Shmei HaTalmud, Lohoyer LeBnei Yisrael B'mosh V'seim Or HaTalmud. In 1931, the Dvar Avram is writing, there is a new star, a rising star, who is going to change the world with learning. By the way, this has nothing to do with the fact that he had a PhD, nothing to do with that, in fact, learning in gymnasia. One Gadol saying about this young Gadol, he was a giant. They tell a story, and you have to be careful about stories about the Rav, because they're Mahabdal, they're like stories about Abraham Lincoln. When you find somebody who's a Gadol, so they say every story about this person. So I can't tell you for sure, but apparently the legend goes that when Rav Soloveitchik went to meet Rav Chaim Ozer, he was talking and learning, and every time that he suggested an idea or an insight, so Rav Chaim Ozer said, oh, that's a very nice insight, and Rav Chaim Ozer had a beautiful library. He said, oh, it's in this safer. So he pulls out some obscure safer and he puts it down, and then he says, oh, you have another idea, very nice, he finds another. By the time he's finished, there's a pile of sperm on the table. So Rav Soloveitchik looked kind of dejected because he thought he had all these chidushei Torah, and Rav Chaim Ozer looked at him and said, why are you despondent? It takes all of those sperms to get into your head. Mind you, when it comes to the world of Chidushei Torah, Rav Schwartz, who should know well, told us that when he went to the first meeting, Rav Schwartz was a member of the first kollel ever in Mies, and I think it was 1950, 1951, so he met for a reception with Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Soloveitchik asked him, what's the point of a kollel? What's the point of learning a kollel? So Rav Schwartz told us that he raised his hand, and he said, in Yiddish, he told him to be Mechadish Chidushin, to innovate new insights into learning. He said when the Rav heard that, he was so hysterical and upset. He thought, Rav Schwartz says, he thought the Rav was going to hit the roof. He started screaming, laughing. Mechadish Chidushin! He went nuts! He was like, we're not Mechadish in a Chidushin. Without Mevarez and Rishonim. We are here just to clarify what it says in the Rishonim. We're not here to say any Chidushin. But we should be aware that when Rav Soloveitchik was Mevarez and Rishonim, he had many Chidushin. But that was not his goal. His goal was not to say that he was shrieking. So you shouldn't think they're going to be Mechadish Chidushin.
What generally, why was this written?
It's a great question. I don't know why
with Varvam wrote this letter and why it was published in Apartheid. But Apartheid was, as we've seen before, kind of like a potpourri of articles and missives and news and hot dog advertisements, and we'll see more. It's like a periodical for people who are interested in the world of Torah. So if the Dvar Avraham wrote this letter, I don't know who it was sent to and why it was sent, but I wonder if this has to do with the fact that Rav Soloveitchik was planning to emigrate to America. I can't say with certainty, probably if you ask people who know more they would know, but it's at this time in 1932 that Rav Soloveitchik emigrates to America, which is on the next page. You actually have the picture and the paper of Rav Soloveitchik's immigration papers. Notice how it's interesting that the Rebbetzin Atara Tversky, Shalom Liwell, her birth date is missing there, you see in the circle. He was born, you see, he was born in February in 1903. They were married on the 16th of June. There you see it's 1931 in Vilna to, it's not on here. I mean, Louis is not on here. I have it on the other page, which I didn't give to you. It says it. Where is, oh, there it is. Wife is Tanya, right there in Vilna. He's sailing from Liverpool, England, which is where the boat was. And if you look on the next page, you actually see the manifest for the boat of alien passengers.
Just from the historical perspective, I find it fascinating to me that I didn't have the citizenship renounced forever, all the reasons for that, but I didn't want to put it to I am not an anarchist. I'm not a
polygamist, nor a believer in polygamy. Exactly.
Polygamy.
So help me God, it says at the end there. Exactly. Now, we should know, Rabbi Rakefet quotes Rabbi Fossman, Zichron Levracha, that Rabbi Fossman describes that originally the way that Rav Soloveitchik was going to be admitted to the United States, because he had been contacted by a school that was going to hire him, known as the Hebrew Theological College, but because of financial hardships, when he arrived in New York, Rav Soloveitchik did not have a position in Chicago, which is why, what's that? She told that story. So he came to New York, where he spent a very brief period of time, but he was contacted by a group in Boston of 11 shuls, and he became essentially the Rav of the year. So if you look on the next page, on the bottom of page 7, that's the ship manifest with Rav Soloveitchik's names, with his and his wife's name, and in the bottom is the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. I don't think that's extant. Dr. Joseph Soloveitchik, a Polish rabbi, his wife and their daughter, Sarah. Notice how they say her name was Sarah, her name was not Sarah, her name was Atala, but if you're looking for a Jewish girl, you call her Sarah. They arrived. They were sent to Kills Island pending a hearing on their status. Rabbis waited in vain at the pier for the appearance of the rabbinical scholar and descendant of rabbis. Dr. Soloveitchik is the son of Dr. Moses Soloveitchik, professor of Talmud Yeshiva College here. At the age of 2, he was able to read Hebrew with ease, and at 12, he had written some manuscripts on religious questions. Yes.
This is a very tumultuous time.
That's right.
What did he say about these times? Did he want to come to America because he foresaw he saw the handwriting on the wall in Europe? Because his father was there? Or what? I mean, he was in Berlin, he was in Lithuania.
So it's a good question. So he actually had applied for a prestigious... So I don't remember the name. I'll say it like this. Years ago, before we were married, so I had the privilege of going on an educational experience. I had a chance to teach a group of teenagers in Australia. So there were a bunch of us young men and women from Yeshiva and from Reeves and from Stern College, and we were going in the summertime, because our summertime is their winter time, and we created these little camps, like in getaways for weekends, Shabbaton type of things for the students in the day school, in the Mizrahi day school in Melbourne, Australia. So before I went to talk to my rabbi, I went to talk to our shester, and I was describing to him some of the things that we were going to do there, and we came up with a lot of creative different kinds of programs, and one of the components of those programs happened to involve a country music song. That was the beginning of my interest in country music. So the country music song that we were going to use, of course I shared it with Rav Schechter, it's a song by Garth Brooks called Unanswered Prayers. You're nodding.
It's a good song. It's an avenue song, as you can tell. So I shared this song, Unanswered Prayers, with Rav Schefter in the Beis Medrash. And the song is about a guy who goes to a reunion from his high school. And he sees the girl who in high school, who every night he prayed to God that she would say yes to him, and she never said yes to him. And now, looking back at the high school reunion many years later, he says, some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. So when I told this to Rav Schefter, so it's not uncommon that he gets emotional about things, so he started to tear up and he started to cry, and he said, this is what Rav Soloveitchik said to us. Because he said he went for a position, and I don't remember the name of the city that he told us, a very prominent position in Poland, in the early, right at the beginning of 1930s, and he applied for the position, and he was rejected. And he said at the time he was very disappointed, and that's when his father, who was in New York at that time, said to him, you know, you should really think about coming to America, they need people in America. So Rav Soloveitchik said to the students, he said, I was very upset and disappointed at that time, but some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers, because he said, if I would have been the rabbi of that community, I would have gone, unfortunately, like Mother Islam, the way of so many in that community. So that's the story. So he arrives in New York, spends a brief period of time here. You can see this letter on line number 8, on page number 8. At this time, by the way, he's an active member of the Agudas Yisrael. This is the Vaher Harabonim of the greater New York. They have a major asifa in their office, and one of their events in their office is on the third line item to tell all the rabbis to come for Kabbalah's Paru Ubirchas Tseishan L'Shalom Goodbye L'Hagon Ha'iloi Pe'er Hador U'Kvod Moreno Harav Rabbeinu Yosef Ber Soloveitchik Shlita. This is in 1932. The titles here are Off the Charts. Off the Charts for a rabbi who's less than 30 years old.
And he just got
and he was, this is in New York. He only been in New York. We're talking about Shmuel Lefano, the letter from the Dvar Avraham, Rav Dober Kahana. This is like not normal description among a cadre of already rabbinic luminaries. So in December of 1932, you see on the next page, the Boston Jewish Advocate, Dr. Soloveitchik installed at Temple Bethel as head of 11 United Orthodox congregations in Boston. So he becomes the, so to speak, the Rav Ha'ir in Boston in 1932. In 1935, he makes his only trip to Israel, applying for the post of the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, which he did not get. When he is there, he delivers his shiur in, next page, page 10, Yeshiva HaMerkazit, Merkaz HaRav. At that time, who was still living? Early 1935, Rav Cook. Rav Cook passes away in Gimel Ellis. So Rav Cook invites Rav Soloveitchik to Beit HaRav, to Merkaz HaRav, to give a shiur. And the description is, HaRav, HaGon, HaGodon, V'chule, V'chule. He's going to shiur in Halacha, in Nishba Levatel, as HaMitzvah B'Kolo, which is a sugya in Shmuis and in Megarim. Be'echal Yeshiva, in Yulal of Sivan, in the spring, meaning right after Pesach, 1935, B'Shah, 12 in the afternoon. This is interesting that Rav Soloveitchik later becomes the head of the Mizrahi, the honorary president of the Religious Zionists of America. And in 1959, after the passing of the Gaon Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, Rav Soloveitchik is approached by many people asking him to apply for the position of the chief rabbi of Israel. So he had already traveled to Israel once. He did not get the position in the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv's office. That went to Rav Amiel from Belgium. And Rav Soloveitchik had the opportunity to go back to Israel in 1960. He actually never traveled to Israel again. And he had, I saw a letter, he has some correspondence about that, some of it having to do with his schedule. Then he, in 1959, had cancer. And then after his wife passed away, that was not for him. But it's interesting that we're not going to take the time to read through, but if you take a look at these letters, he describes how he did consider becoming the chief rabbi of Israel in 1960, but after thinking about the fact that it would require political machinations that he wasn't interested in, he wouldn't be able to run the Torah program that he really wanted, he decided he was going to abandon that. That's 11 and 12. Let's go back to page 13. Let's go back to 1937, where you find here
the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Department of Corporations and Taxation. They gathered together to create a new entity, which is called Maimonides Educational Institute, Inc. Ralph Silvercik founds the Maimonides Day School. And these are the original signatories on the page. Next page, Rudolf Steinberg, Joseph Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Jacobson, Rabbi Aaron Gorovitz. And this was Rav Soloveitchik's major achievement in Boston, you could say, with the partnership of his wife. His daughter, one of his daughters, I forget where I read this, said that he felt so strongly about this and that he appreciated more the people who sent their children to this day school in 1938, more even than the people who gave money. Because he said, people gave money, that was a big deal in 1938. But to risk and send your child to a day school in Boston, that was remarkable. So this was something that, when they didn't have heat in the building, they came to the Soloveitchik home, the students, and they learned in the living room. And this was the Rebbetzin, this is Tanya Soloveitchik's life work, was working primarily on the school. And the Rav was very involved. This was very central. Turn to page 15. In 1939, he created a yeshiva. 1939. In the middle, you see Commonwealth of Massachusetts. What is the name of this yeshiva? It was known, as you see on the top, it's actually cut off slightly, Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi. Rav Soloveitchik starts a small yeshiva in Boston, known as the Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi, the Institute of Teaching, in the name of who is Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi, his grandfather, at the urging of his father, who was a beat. However, in late 1940, with the passing of Dr. Bernard Revel, in the early 1941, January 1941, was the passing of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So that year, in 1941, the board of directors of Yeshiva decided, you know, there's this young guy, he was the son, maybe they should give him a trial. So they gave him a one-year trial contract to see if he was worth his mettle. They offered him, we'll take you on a temporary basis. And then it's announced in Apartheid, here we go, on page 16, January 1944. Actually, I'll go to 17 first. I'll come back to 16 in a second. What's the latest news? On the left side is Chag Hanachas HaEvan L'Mosad HaBinyan Shal Yeshivas Neir Yisrael in Baltimore. In 1941, this is the founding of Yeshivas Neir Yisrael by Rabbi Ruderman Zichrono Livracha. On the right-hand side is the first, I don't know if it's the first, but it's a significant visit. Remember, 1941, Rav Aaron Kuller just arrives in America. Rav Aaron Kuller speaks in Brooklyn. And on the top, Hashir HaRishon by Yeshiva. The first shir of Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik in Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanan in New York. It was said in Ulam Rov Rabbani HaYom New York, arrived to listen to the shir, which was in the sugya of Osius Nicholas Mimasira, a Choshen Mishpat topic. Everybody was there, and everybody was blown away by the shir, which took place on the 15th of Iyar, on Tuesday the 15th of Iyar, 1941.
So how long was he
then? Well, let's see, it was back in 1903.
So it's
38. Yes.
I'm glad I also read about the period. And I felt like I was even more
So that's what we're going to get to right now. Look and go back to page 16. He was very welcomed by the Orthodox rabbis in Boston, but he was not welcomed by the meat packers in Boston. The meat packers. Because what happened was, when Rav Soloveitchik arrived, the state of slaughter was a disaster. Shoftim sometimes had to work 24-hour shifts, and the standard of kashrus was very low, and their pay was paltry. So Rav Soloveitchik moved to create better standards for the shoftim and better pay, and to get them together, and so he instituted a lot of reforms. But that was met with tremendous resistance by the meat packers, who accused him of racketeering and all kinds of other things. So this dragged on for several years during this period. and during which time he was supported by many Orthodox rabbis, including someone who was not from the Orthodox community, a man by the name of Rabbi Joseph Shubal. You see on the left here, this is a conservative rabbi writing a piece in Hapardes, in English, because this was brought to Judge A.K. Cohn, who reports on the, he is the venerable jurist and a distinguished leader of the Jewish community, on the Attorney General's inquiry in the racketeering charges against Rav Soloveitchik involving the Shochtim, and how he describes that it was a slanderous charge and vicious accusations that were completely false. And you see it's called on the top right in Hebrew in the rabbinic section, Maise Boston. The story of the slander, how the business people went after the Rav, and at the end of the day he was 100% and completely vindicated by the judge. And that was a very complicated and nasty parsha, exactly like this. In 1941, he moves to Yeshiva, although he does not move his residence. He still lives in Boston, commutes back and forth. He begins by getting two shiurim in Gemara every week, and at that time he also is giving lectures in the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. He's giving lectures in Jewish philosophy. He closes the Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi because he moves to Reef. The students are now beginning to multiply in the 1940s. That's when Rav Schwartz studied there in the late 1940s. And in 1946, he becomes the honorary president of the Religious Zionists of America. So he moves away from the Agudah and becomes very active in Mizrahi. And in 1953, he becomes the chairman of the Vad HaHalacha of the Rabbinical Council of America, which is a very significant position. RCA, which is now the RCA has over 1,000 member rabbis, full disclosure, I am a member of the RCA, and Rav Soloveitchik's position as the chairman of the Vad HaHalacha solidified his role essentially as the posik hador for all those rabbis and musmachim and adherents of our community who are members of the RCA. One very noteworthy psak, which was in contradistinction to a psak that was offered here in Chicago, was Rav Soloveitchik's view on mechitzas in shuls. This next piece you see on page 18 comes from this volume called The Sanctity of the Synagogue. Rav Soloveitchik sent a message to the RCA convention that he could not attend. He says, "I'm so sorry I can't be at the RCA convention this time." And he says in the bottom, he says, "The RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, stands now at the crossroads and must decide either to assume boldly and courageously the time-honored, by ages sanctified role of the traditional rabbinate with traces of very strong language," go to page 19. "In particular, I wish to call the attention of the conference to the mechitza problem. I continually receive reports from laymen and from all parts of the country, accusing many rabbis of displaying indecisiveness and even cowardice in this matter. They charge them with laxity and indifference. I do hereby reiterate the statement," next paragraph, "that I have made on numerous occasions, both in writing and orally, that a synagogue with a mixed seating arrangement forfeits its sanctity and its halachic status of a mikdash ma'at and is unfit for prayer and avodah shebelev. With full cognizance of the implications of such a halachic decision, I would advise every Orthodox Jew to forego tefillah b'tzibur even on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, rather than enter a synagogue with mixed pews, notwithstanding that the fact that the officiating rabbi happens to be a graduate of a great and venerable yeshiva."
This is in the
1950s. Go to the next page and he tells you the Maisa Shahaya. Top right, who wants to read this story? Go ahead.
To make absolutely clear my position on this latest question, I would like to relate this incident. A young man moved into a suburb of Boston where the only existent synagogue had men and women sitting together. He asked me what to do on the high holy days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Until then, on account of the mixed seating, he had not entered the synagogue. But on the days of one, he was very reluctant to remain at home. I answered him that it were better for him to pray at home both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that crossed the threshold of that synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in that synagogue. And this man had warned him that if he did not come to the synagogue, he simply would not be the shofar. But the man would not sound the shofar again privately for his benefit. The young man practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for half an hour, and he might hear the shofar blast. I hesitated not at all. He made me a promise that we'd be better to go to the shofar than be under a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned.
Period. As the same Hebrew, Ein Kel Malkum L'Haaretz. We don't have time today to discuss this issue at length, but if you want, there's a lot more background and details and correspondence in this volume. But this is significant because now Rav Soloveitchik, as the chairman of the Vaad Halacha of the RCA, his position is going to be the standard, the halachic position for all RCA communities. In 1956, Rav Soloveitchik delivers an address which we're not going to have time to talk about today. He talks about six knocks. This address relates to the Holocaust and the second part of it to the new state of Israel, and then it's amended later after the 1967 Six-Day War.
So when you're using
this is 1956, called Kol Dodi Dofeik. The voice of my beloved and not is knocking. And here Rav Soloveitchik articulates a religious worldview, how we should think about the state of Israel and the nature of the Hashgacha and the Yad Hashem, the hand of God, which is knocking for us as a community to answer. So he talks about it on the political ones, on the political frame, on the theological standpoint, on many different knocks, which we don't have time, maybe we should spend one whole morning talking about Kol Dodi Dofeik. But if we talk about our Masorah, and you talk about how we're going to form our view of religious Zionism, so this talk, this Kol Dodi Dofeik lecture, is going to play a very significant role. In 1967, you see on the next page, the Rebbetzin passes away right before Purim, and this changed his life, even though Briskers traditionally would not, they wouldn't frequent cemeteries, but people describe that Rav Soloveitchik, after the passing of his wife, visited the cemetery every week shortly after she passed away, and he was deeply affected by her loss in many different ways. That's just you see here the Jewish advocate. And then in the early 1980s, his health starts to fail, and he spends the rest of his period starting, I think, in like 1983, 1984, receded from the public eye, living with his children, living with the tourist streets in Boston. And he passes away. You see on page 23, this is the obituary in the New York Times, April 10th, 1993. And then you see on the last page, you see the Matzeva, the Sher Matzeva, on the last page of page 24, on the right side, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, on the left side, Tanya Levitt Soloveitchik. And then I gave you at the end just the summary of the notes. And hopefully this, just back of the baseball card stats, gives us a little bit of insight into the life and times of Rav Soloveitchik, so we can have a greater appreciation moving forward to who he was and what he taught us and what he stood for and how significant that is for our Missouri. Yeah, Paul. Yes. Yes, the Maimonides, he was right, so he was, there were some interesting questions about whether or not his position on mixed education in Maimonides, was that because it was a necessity, or that's what he believed in the matter of principle. I think many point out that, I'm trying to remember who articulated this specifically. I know he himself wrote about this in a letter in this volume, which is very important. If you want to get a beautiful insight into Rav Soloveitchik's perspectives firsthand, it comes from this volume called Community, Covenant, and Commitment, Selected Letters and Communications. So one of the things that Rav Soloveitchik felt very strongly about, and this was evidenced by his, even though living the first year in Tel Aviv, in Stern College, was that women need
to have as strong and as sophisticated and as all-encompassing an education in the world of Torah as their male counterparts. So the observation felt that in today's day and age, you know, Chafetz Chaim opened the door to women's education with the study of Torah Shabbat, and Rav Soloveitchik pioneered the advanced Torah learning for women. So it could be that the reason for the mixed setting was because otherwise, and I think he writes this in a letter, otherwise he felt that if it would be separate, they wouldn't be afforded the same rigor of an education. I don't know what he would say about other educational frameworks for other communities, but certainly the idea that women needed in today's day and age, and they still need an outstanding Torah education of the highest caliber, that was something that was, you know, he articulates that in some of the letters in this book. Yes, sure. Sure. Yes. That maybe on a personal level that was true, but certainly on a communal level he was incredibly strong in his views. So what did Aguda think of him? That is a loaded question, which when we're out of time, let's put it this way. The Gedolim of every community everywhere had the utmost respect for Rav Soloveitchik. He was revered. He was invited in the 1950s by Rav Aaron Cutler, I think it was 1955 or 1956, to give the keynote address at the Chinuch Hatzmai dinner. By that time, he was well settled in the Mizrahi community, and he had a very close personal relationship with Rav Moshe Feinstein. When Rav Moshe passed away, the Rav was in very ill health, so they did not tell him. And after Pesach, Rav Moshe passed away before Pesach. After Pesach, the Rav apparently remarked to one of the Shemeshim, one of the boys who was taking care of him, "Why didn't you tell me that Rav Moshe passed away?" So he said, "How do we know?" He said, "Well, we know we used to call each other before every Yom Tov. And he didn't call me. So I knew that something happened, but he didn't tell me." So Rav Soloveitchik had the approbation and the esteem of every goyim who was worth anything. And I'll give you one more. Yeah, all right, more anecdotes for a different time, but I've kind of...